Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. How consciously do you use your senses? While many works of art engage our faculties, few of them encourage us to think about how we perceive space, light, color, even time. My guest today has established a global reputation by challenging people to consider these things. Olafur Eliasson's Take Your Time exhibition brings about 20 large-scale works to the Dallas Museum of Art and allows audiences not simply to view the works, but to move around within them. The artist is here to talk about his goals for the installation. Olafur, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Let's talk about the title to start off with, Take Your Time. You really want us to think about time in a variety of ways.
Well, taking your time is not just the way you would walk through the museum and choosing to do it slow one day. It's also about considering that time is something that you could actively make for yourself in terms of not, you know, rather than being slow, you could say, I take back my time. I take it and I claim this is my time and I want to, let's say, produce it the way I prefer. There's something about it, with this whole idea of time, there's something which for me is about how do we experience and how do we, you know, go out in the world and, you know, how are we in the world? And suddenly the idea that you constitute time or you create your own time is something that I think is interesting as a concept rather than, let's say, consuming time. And of course, being in a museum or in an art institution, the whole idea of not consuming but producing is, I think, a nice way of looking at art.
Well, it's a really challenging thing, I guess, to ask an audience to consider time in that so many works of art, including sculptures, which are three-dimensional, very carefully shape those three dimensions, but the fourth one, it's almost as if it doesn't exist. No one really even considers it when they're looking at just a sort of standard work of sculpture. But with yours, you're really inside those three dimensions, so maybe that makes time easier.
Yeah, I think... generally speaking, we live in a society where temporality is normally chopped up and sold in small pieces, and the kind of temporal quality of an experience is not something that is very often talked about because it's very hard to commodify and sell. It's very hard to kind of, you know, it's so relative, it's unpredictable, right? So of course, the quality in an art exhibition, I would claim, is that the way you go through the show, you create your own exhibition. You go from this space to that painting, to this photograph, to this sculpture. And there's a sequence there. There's a sort of a temporal some kind of journey, you could say, where you somehow curate, if you want, your own little narrative or your own story. So the whole idea of, let's say, giving time back to the people is really also about suggesting that you are, in a sense, responsible for the way you take in the world or for the way you produce your own world. And in that sense, there is an element of, you know, responsibility or social question. Maybe the whole idea of that you do have a kind of an ability to impact on your surroundings. It's just about understanding that the surroundings are, to a greater extent at least, constructed. They're models, and if we see them as such, we are also able to challenge them, reevaluate them, and potentially also change them.
You've said that your work is ultimately about people. And I'm wondering if you also, when you were talking about people in the exhibition and sort of observing them moving through it, do you think of them as a sort of a medium as well? Are they part of the installation once they're there and reacting to it?
Well, normally I say the core of my work is really the dialogue between the people in front of the machine that I say then create the relationship. So the situation really between the work of art or the machine or whatever we call it and the spectator or the viewer or the user, the visitor, that relationship is where I think the potential is. So that is what I think is potentially also a work of art. I have used then different medias. I've used ideas from science, from nature, to natural phenomena. But these are more tools. These are more kind of, you know, the language, and the matter is, of course, what you then say with this language, or what is the quality of the dialogue that a work of art is about. So this relationship between a person and whatever I do is what I'm interested in. If there were no people, there would also be no art. It simply doesn't work like that. And of course, the interesting idea about this is that it's much more relative then, because when you look at it, you see something. When I look at it, I see something different. And suddenly we see, you know, things. Or there's a kind of acceptance that you and I are not the same. And if you think about where do we find this? Where do we find the kind of acceptance of diversity in this way? Think about a commercial environment where then you have the kind of, you know, somebody selling you a pair of jeans. Of course, that person has an interest in that everybody thinks the same about that pair of jeans, right? So in that sense, you could claim that a commercial environment typically has a sort of a normative way of defining how do we experience, where an artwork or a museum or an institution communicating artistic ideas, that has an interest in a kind of a non-normative experience, a kind of a supporting diversity or being, at least not being generalizing. And in that, in there, there is a potential, because suddenly you are in a situation, museum or not, but you're in a situation where you're suddenly both being an individual, but you also are tolerant for kind of collectivity, for an idea about collectivity, because you're not alone in the museum. And I know you're going to see something different than I did, and yet we are able to talk to each other. And if you think about it, this is really unique, the fact that we are both together, and also we are also individual. That means we are both singular and plural, but not either or, of first this and then this. We are both at the same time as one thing. So it's like about being, and the only way of being is being with. And so of course I'm down into some smaller thoughts about, so what is, you know, what constitutes collectivity, and if you have that, you can talk about community, you can talk about democracy if you want, you can talk about much more complex ideas. And of course this was always ideas that you would find in good art.
When people come into a museum or a gallery, they are at least expecting to see works of art, and they sort of put themselves in a frame of mind where they're ready to interact with that. What's the difference in the experience when you put a work of art out in public, where people might, in fact, just stumble upon it and may or may not even recognize it as a work of art, but they still are confronted with it?
I mean, I think art is capable of working in many, many different environments, and one should not think that a museum is a kind of a free space or a neutral space. Of course, a museum or an art institution is a very kind of manicured way, which has a very specific kind of communication ideology, you could say, right? So, and going out into the street, we are also not in a neutral space, which is, you know, free or a public space. Doesn't mean that the space is kind of free of interest. Of course, any public space or any public sphere, if you want, also has all kinds of intentionalities or, you know, power structures, if you want, or political structures and the law and all these things built into it. So also the street, of course, very different than a museum, but it's also full of a very complex and very dynamic range of elements. So working on the street just means taking all these other elements into consideration. The fact that people might not know that they are encountering a work of art can be very productive. Or that can be, how should I say it? I mean, sometimes you are in a situation where people look at something and they go, ah, it's a work of art. Well, then it's okay, because then it's not as threatening, right? But so you are sometimes in a situation on a public, in the context of a public sphere where people don't know whether it's a work of art. And there's that degree of uncertainty. There's this requirement that you need to negotiate what on earth you are seeing. Suddenly you are forced to engage in a slightly different manner, and people go like, do I like this? Don't I like this? Is it questionable? I don't necessarily think it needs to be, you know, threatening or anything like, but just the fact that it's a little bit unpredictable. And there's just not so much unpredictable space or matter left in the way we organized everything, right? Of course, it can be very liberating, but we also have to see that it's more about the kind of the ping pong between the two. I think there is a moment where you then say, "Aha, it is a work of art," and then what does that mean? That suddenly you realize, "Oh, somebody actually did this. I thought just something fell over, but it was on purpose." and what's the potential of that? So I don't think. I just think it's a little more complex than just saying inside of a museum is like this and outside is like something else and like this. It's a kind of a, you know, what can each of the situations learn and benefit from each other.
How different do you think a particular work is when it is shown in a city like Dallas as opposed to Los Angeles or New York or London or Berlin? Does the meaning of the work change for you?
Oh, of course it does. Yes, absolutely. I mean, a work is by definition not the objecthood. Of course, the work is the kind of relationships that this particular situation generates around the work. And you could say that people, when coming to the Dallas Museum, for instance, they have expectations. And here in Dallas, they have other expectations than in other places. Here, there is a specific relationship with light, with environment, that is different than people would have it in London, for instance. So in that way, one could claim that the show almost already starts when people start to anticipate what they are about to see. Because these expectations, they color the experience once you then have the experience, and then of course afterwards you then have memories. So there's like kind of a pro-tension and retention, the kind of a stretch of time where the exhibition is not just what you see in the museum, it's also what you expect and what you remember afterwards. And that's what makes it very unique, depending on if you are in a local environment where there's a particular history, that history will always influence the particular or the explicit exhibition.
How does the excitement for you compare with the moment that you have thought of a work that you want to create? How does that compare with the moment that the work is finished and you can look at it and it's ready to go?
I don't think that the works ever really finish in that way. It's not like a painter. I wonder whether a painter actually even think about it this way, but it's not like a painter. Then I say, okay, now I paint a painting, and now I'm finished. The works are in a sense always a kind of a model, and it's always a process. And as I said before, the work is not necessarily interesting unless somebody experiences it, and then that experience becomes the subject matter, so to speak. And in that way. I mean, there's not this kind of before and after with my work. I think I have a studio in Berlin, and I have a group of people helping me, a wonderful team of 30 specialists, and we work on things in different scale. You say it's a model, first a small, maybe it's a drawing first, maybe it's a computer drawing, then a small analog model or paper model or wooden model or a steel model. It gets more and more kind of, it sort of grows, you could say. There's an evolution and there's a lot of experiments. It's like a laboratory almost. And suddenly you're out on the street, you're testing it in one scale, 1:1, and suddenly it's inside of a museum. But if you think about it, a museum is not necessarily the final, the final house. A museum is also, fundamentally also a very strange thing. So you put these objects, these experiments into this, and then other people come and look at it. Of course, this is just the beginning. It has only just begun.
Are the people on your team, do you think of them as executing your vision, or are their ideas part of your process?
I think of them, I have a much more pragmatic relationship to this, because there are so many things that I'm not so good at, and every time I run into an issue that I'm having a hard time with, I get somebody to help me with it. And this is why I have so many people, because I'm really incompetent in many different fields. But there is some truth to it, because I am, for instance, really bad at drawing at a computer. And the thing is that I think about a problem, and only by visualizing the problem in some kind of form or some kind of language, I can get into the core of the problem, and then I can challenge it. So I need somebody to help me, give the problem a structure before I can solve it. And of course, the person who then draws it on a computer, for instance, gets into the problem with me, right? So you have a conversation about it, and this kind of evolution start. But typically, I would say that I control the trajectory of the problems, right? So. And then there is within that all kinds of different more or less collaborative, and sometimes I just demand a solution, and sometimes we work together, and sometimes somebody else actually comes up with a great solution, and sometimes we do kind of 20 solutions and we sit down for months and think about which one is the right one and so on. So there's not, it's not like a kind of assembly line system where we have a kind of a rhythm into it. We change the organization of the studio and the way we work quite a bit.
Last thing I wanted to ask you about, and quickly, unfortunately, is I know that you've rejected the idea that artists are different from everyone else and that somehow they understand things in a fundamentally different way. What's the danger in everyone looking at artists in that way?
Now, I mean, I have an interest in being a participant in society. I have an interest in being a responsible person. I want to be, taken serious. That's why, for an artist, it occasionally pays off to say, well, I'm mainstream. I talk to normal people, I eat normal food, and I do normal things. This, I think, gives me a greater, let's say, place in society, being an artist, being a part of, or being in the center of society, rather than being, avant-garde or being outside of society. Where I come from, Scandinavia, by the time I went to art academy, it was considered stepping out of, the productive society, right? So, and I always felt very sad that people, where I say I'm an artist, and people say, "Oh, you're an artist. Oh, he's a clown." And in that sense, I made an effort to, claim that art is, co-producing reality.
Oliver, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you.
You can see the exhibition Take Your Time at the DMA through March 15th. Just ahead on Think, from newspapers to new media, a new book recounts the history of the Belo Corporation. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for this weekend features Amor in España, a European musical celebration, and wide open spaces. Opening at the Marty Walker Gallery, come out for the brand new exhibit Vacant Spaces, featuring explorations of unpopulated landscapes via photography, painting, and video from four artists. For the latest ink drawings from Houston artist John Adelman, the Holly Johnson Gallery invites you out for the Up to Half opening, showcasing Adelman's rule-based dictionary-inspired works. If you're hoping to kick off 2009 with the likes of Strauss, Brahms, and Mussorgsky, make your way to the Meyerson as Jaap van Zweden leads the DSO in an evening of waltzes through the weekend. And at Theater 3, come out for Jack Alder's interpretation of the cheeky Spanish cloak-and-dagger love story Tristan Toledo, which follows the amorous exploits of nobles and their servants. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
Does a single media organization reflect the evolution of an entire industry? In her new book about the one-time parent company of the Dallas Morning News, WFAA Television, and dozens of other media properties, Judith Garrett-Segura traces an empire that began with a single newspaper founded in Galveston in 1842. The book is called Belo, From Newspapers to New Media. Judith, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
So I know that you worked as an archivist for Belo before you stopped to write this book. Does that mean that all the records were complete and in one place and easy to access for everything?
Oh, no. In fact, I didn't work as an archivist. I actually ran their foundation. But it was because I was doing research about the company and found materials were scattered everywhere that I started pulling them together and just accidentally created the archives. I mean, just by process of years and years of saying, oh my goodness, I didn't know we had this, in some filing cabinet somewhere. There then was an archive. So by the time I wanted to really focus on writing a book using the material, it was really well organized and all in one place.
Amazing to think that in 1842, Texas wasn't even the state of Texas. It was the Republic of Texas.
That's right.
What kind of stories was the paper covering back then?
Well, they were covering daily life, and for the most part, local daily life. And when the Galveston Daily News, which, by the way, still publishes, they're now called the Galveston County Daily News, or they might just be the Galveston County News. It is no longer part of Belo, and it hasn't been since 1923. But it's the oldest continuously published newspaper in Texas. But when it started in 1842, there were 18 other newspapers in Galveston at the time, and the population couldn't have been more than a couple of thousand people. So they were talking about what was happening in town, and that was the big city in Texas at the time, so the metropolitan area.
So the move to Dallas meant the Dallas Morning News, and also, of course, later on, radio and television properties. Mm-hmm. And in 1922, there was the first radio station for Beeline?
Yes, uh-huh. And they named that WFAA radio. This was before the convention of having radio stations that were east of the Mississippi with W and those west with K's to begin with. They gave it this WFAA name and then grandfathered it in and kept it later.
So a couple of decades later, they decided they wanted to have an FM station, mm-hmm. which was called KERA.
That's right. That's how KERA came to life, was as Belo's first foray into FM radio, which, by the way, they decided to start instead of investing in television when the first licenses were available, putting them a little bit behind the game in some ways. So it was a management decision that almost did a misstep there. FM radio is still around too, but still they're simultaneous developments.
So eventually WFAA television came about, and in fact was again located at this building that's now
right.
Channel 13.
Mm-hmm. This was their first building for WFAA television too.
Mm-hmm. How do you think certainly no one expected back then the evolution into new media, but there were some misstarts at first. There was the QCAT debacle when everything mm-hmm. started, but then that really sort of opened the door for a lot of changes that have stuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, the QCAT wasn't the first foray into new media. It actually began in the early 80s with something that was called Belo Information Systems Online Network, or BISON, BISON, and it was text, newspaper, on screen, in homes for people with computers. But in the early 80s, there weren't enough computers, enough in people's homes. So although it was a great idea and it was launched, it couldn't survive because it didn't have enough watchers or viewers or readers online. But then the QCAT was essentially kind of an advertising gimmick. It wasn't really designed to provide news to readers so much as it was to get people to notice what it is, you know, that newspapers have always been funded by the advertisers. So it was not well thought out. Didn't last very long, but it wasn't really intended to be delivering the news product like new media is now. I mean, new media really is delivering the news product electronically.
Well, and it seems to be happening, working very well for Belo. So thank you so much
yes.
for coming in.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
The book is called Belo, From Newspapers to New Media. For free video and audio podcasts, you can go to kera.org/think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. By the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas. providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive. And by the valued support of KERA members. Thank you.